101.5 FM, donate to the station, and become a member of Vancouver's only community-owned and run radio station. As a member-owned cooperative, Co-op Radio doesn't have one owner. We have about 30,000 owners. We don't accept commercial advertising. We generate our revenue through donations from our members and listeners. Donate to Co-op Radio, become a member, and help us continue to make independent alternative radio. Visit coopradio.org to donate today.
Okay, and the time is now 5:14, and you are listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and also streaming at www.cooperadio.org. This is Bulin Awaz, and today we're going to be speaking with Greg Felton, somebody that we've spoken to a number of times. We've had you, Greg, on The Rational previously, and let me just tell listeners a little bit about Greg. Is an investigative journalist specializing in the Middle East, Canadian politics, the media, and language, and he holds a master's degree in political science from the University of British Columbia. You speak a number of European languages and Mandarin as well, and for 6 years has written a political column for the monthly Arab English Canadian Arab News, and his articles have appeared on a number of platforms. And you also have a blog called Politics Unspun.
That's right.
Greg, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And so I asked you to come by and just give us some analysis, some points of view. When you look at the situation currently that is has been exploding over in the Ukraine, we remember the airline flight also that was downed, and some very, very tense moments over the last little while. Of course, this goes back to the American Empire and George Bush and all the rest of the stuff. So can you just maybe give us some contextual sort of history around this issue?
About the Malaysian flight 17?
About Ukraine in general, and then start, you know, bringing in issues that you see are of concern for us Canadians to be aware of.
Well, when the Soviet Union fractured at the end of the 1980s, early 90s, the republics that were part of the USSR became independent. And when that happened, the great enemy of the West, the Soviet Union, ceased to exist. Now, at the time, President Bush, Ronald Reagan's successor, saw an opportunity to meet with Mikhail Gorbachev, who was head of Russia at the time, the new independent Russian state, to work out a peace agreement in the Middle East. And he thought the Russian philosophy of perestroika и гласность was a great idea, as a great attempt to put aside decades of Cold War hostilities. Well, at the time, the Jewish lobby in America got rather upset with this, particularly people in the Pentagon like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. These are Israel's controllers in the Pentagon, and these are the people who make policy. And as I show in my book, The Host and the Parasite, Israel is in firm control of American military policy. Israel expects America to be its bully. Israel will make the bullets and America will fire them. Israel does not want to be seen doing its own dirty work. So in the case of Russia, this became quite a problem. What to do with a country that was no longer an enemy? And what happened throughout the 1990s into the 2000s and so forth, Russia seemed to be far less of a problem than in the past. And Russia kept up its traditional alliances with many of the Muslim states in the Middle East, particularly Syria. Now, what that means for the United States is that if it wants to do anything in the Middle East of a particularly violent nature, it needs to have Russia's acceptance. The United Nations Security Council, which has long since degenerated into America's private billy club, needs to have consensus in the Security Council. Sorry, it needs to have unanimity in the Security Council among the five permanent members. And so far, Russia has refused to betray the Syrian government and sees the attempt to bomb Syria as a gratuitous act of wanton violence that will achieve nothing. In his refusal to approve the sanctions against the bombing or sanctions against Syria, Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, said, look, we want to de-escalate the violence. We want to come to some sort of an agreement. There's no need to go and make more trouble, bomb more people. This is not the way to achieve any sort of resolution. And this has happened consistently at the UN. And this poses a problem for the United States, or as I prefer to call it, Israel-America. Because you can't do anything if Russia is going to behave itself and stick to such arcane concepts as reason and the rule of law and humanitarian conduct. Now, this poses a problem, as I said, and this is why we find numerous little, I don't know, feints or tactics to push Russia to do what America wants. And we see this in a number of areas. And I think not the least of which was the Malaysian Airline Flight 17. Although anything that we could say about it would be pure speculation because we can't have access to the information that's been kept from us. But we do know that this was not a Russian shoot down. Russia had no interest in shooting down a commercial jetliner. And what's interesting particularly is not so much what happened to the plane, but how quickly and how reflexively and how uncritically the Western media rushed to blame Russia. It was a Russia to judgment is what it was. And that tells me something very, very sneaky and very dirty is going on here. It's very similar to the way the World Trade Center towers were blamed on the Muslim hijackers. Even within a few seconds after it happening, we had instant experts come up, oh, this is what happened. We have the same sort of knee-jerk attitude toward MH17. And I submit that this is part of a calculated campaign to demonize Russia and to ostracize it in the world.
Right, okay. And so that could be an interesting way of looking at things, that they need an enemy. They need to demonize Russia. For the last number of years, they were also producing an enemy, which were the Muslims, who still are the enemy. And then recent events in the Ukraine has surfaced again. What is Canada doing hosting the Prime Minister of Ukraine? And, they should have commemorated
the Ukrainian community a long time ago, but they just chose to do it recently.
Well, until recently, the government of Ukraine was led by a man named Viktor Yanukovych, who was the duly elected leader of Ukraine, and he was sympathetic to Russia. He wanted closer ties with Russia rather than closer ties with NATO. Ukraine is in an impossible position. It's a very poor country. It's probably the poorest country in Eastern Europe, arguably. On the one hand, it has a traditional animosity toward Russia. I mean, let's not forget that during the 1930s and 20s, Stalin deliberately starved 10 million Ukrainians in what is known in Ukrainian as the Holodomor. And it is the single greatest mass murder in the 20th century. And so Ukrainians naturally do not want to have much to do with Russians. They want nothing to do with Russia. Well, very little to do with it. So many Western Ukrainians, Western-minded Ukrainians, look toward the West, toward Europe, Western Europe, like France, Germany, England, possibly the United States, as a way to fix their political and economic interests. The only problem with that is once you sign up with NATO, you end up, it's essentially like joining a gang. You essentially can't get out. You have to do certain things. You give up certain freedoms. You allow the gang to come into your territory and do certain things. You cease to be really independent. So on the one hand, you surrender your independence to NATO, or you live a quasi-independent existence with your traditional enemy, Russia. And Yanukovych chose Russia, and for political and economic reasons, it made sense. I mean, Russia is a border country. Russia is the source of the natural gas and oil that keeps the Ukrainian economy flowing. There's great trade possibility with Ukrainian wheat going to Russia. There's no reason not to form a close economic political tie with Russia. The problem for the West is that with the independence of Ukraine from the Soviet Union, Ukraine and other countries looked like ripe pickings for countries to be brought into NATO. And this has the effect of putting an enemy right on Russia's border. During the Cold War, of course, we had the buffer states of Eastern Europe protecting or separating Russia from Western rockets, missiles, and so forth. So there was a certain cordon sanitaire, if you want to call it that, between the two sides. But with the breakup of the Soviet Union and the liberation of the East European countries, there is no safety. There's nothing left. You can imagine Russia's discomfiture at the thought of having medium-range nuclear missiles in eastern Ukraine pointed at Moscow or St. Petersburg or Smolensk or any other city in Russia. Russia would not be free to act in its own interest. It would have to worry about starting a nuclear war. And this is aggression. This is brinksmanship being played by the United States. And this lies behind the coup d'etat that took place in Kyiv earlier this year, when the government of Yanukovych was expelled and a bunch of neo-fascists led by Arkady Yatsenyuk was installed as head of Ukraine. What took place in Ukraine was utterly illegal, completely illegal, because Vladimir Putin, the head of Russia, knows perfectly well what the terms are for removing a president of Ukraine. It had to be death, serious health condition, impeachment, and there was no constitution-based impeachment, or resignation. And this is a speech he gave earlier this year, and quite clearly, Viktor Yanukovych is still the legitimate president of Ukraine. But you see, Yatsenyuk owes his existence to the Israelis and the Americans and the Europeans, who admittedly spent something like $3 billion to destabilize Ukraine. This was admitted by a State Department flunky who openly said this was a campaign. This is what we spent to get rid of Yanukovych. That was Victoria, and the name escapes me at the moment. It was the term that I'll recognize her name. It'll come to me later on in the show. But she essentially was the woman who admitted that there was a $3 billion expenditure to destabilize Ukraine. And we had fighting in the streets. There were Israelis on the ground there. And So we had this coup d'etat. It was transparently ham-fisted. It was illegal, but it's what what the United States wanted. Now, with Yatsenyuk as the leader, the idea of joining NATO becomes even closer. And this goes back to 2008, at least, when George W. Bush, before he left office, was trying to push for inclusion of both Georgia and the Ukraine. And he did so for reasons that were very vague or very ill-defined. But the European countries, the Allies, and Russia did not want this. They knew what it would mean. They knew what putting missiles on the border of Russia would be very destabilizing. So this idea of exploiting Ukraine as an independent country to be a forward base for NATO missiles has been in the works for over 6 years, at least. And this is why the Russians got very agitated when the government of Ukraine was overthrown. The eastern part of Ukraine is predominantly Russian-speaking. The western part is predominantly Ukrainian-speaking. The eastern part is predominantly Russian Orthodox. The western part is both Ukrainian Catholic and Ukrainian Orthodox. So we have essentially both a religious and a linguistic divide in Ukraine. And that tells you a lot about what people think of Russia. The Easterners have a far more positive impression than the Westerners do. So when the government was overthrown, the Russians' troops, which were already in Ukraine, this is nothing that was new, they started to mobilize, they started to protect their interests. And instantly, the world blamed Russia for invading Ukraine, for invading the Crimea, which was patent rubbish. But it didn't matter because overthrowing the government was an excuse to start yet another campaign to demonize Russia.
Right.
And what that meant for the West is that they could have a massive propaganda campaign. They could ask for sanctions against Russia. They could bring the United Nations into it. They could try to have them ostracized from hosting the Olympic Games in 2018, which they're still trying to do, I believe. But all of this has to do with the fact that Russia will not support the United States where it counts. And that's in the United Nations Security Council against Syria. And I believe if you took Syria out of the equation, you would have far less interest in demonizing Russia.
It's a really interesting analysis. I mean, it's sort of like, why does the old enemy become relevant and present today when, for example, the last 12 years, the attention has been directed away from the Soviet Union as an enemy towards, Islam as an enemy?
Islam as an enemy was essentially manufactured in the early 90s when Israel needed to expand beyond Palestinians and Arabs as definable targets. But in order to prosecute the campaign against Islam, you need to have cooperation from many different sources. And one of them is Russia.
Right. And so since Russia does not go with the votes that the U.S. wants, therefore they have to continually beat them into it.
That's right. I mean, Russia has to be bludgeoned into doing what America wants because as the hegemon of the world, America does not acknowledge challenges to its own self-interest. It does not acknowledge dissent. It is an imperial power as cruel and absolutist as Athens was after the Persian Wars. If you remember, just a quick history, after the after the Battle of Salamis, which pretty much ended Persian presence on the mainland of Greece, the remaining allies of the war ended up becoming, very rich, especially Athens. See, Athens benefited from having money or food or other sort of goods in kind given to them as payment for their defense of the smaller islands and other parts of Greece, especially the Ionian coast. And when the war ended, Athens got very used to having all this tribute paid to them. So the alliance against the Persians morphed into what was called the Delian League, surrounding the island of Delos, which became the NATO of its day, against the dreaded Persian Empire. The problem is once you were in the alliance, you couldn't get out. You were coerced into joining. You were murdered. You were subjected to all kinds of coercion if you didn't do what the Athenians wanted. And ultimately, this led to the Peloponnesian War. So what Athens did to its allies by exploiting them and treating them badly, intimidating them and running an alliance like a personal dictatorship, they caused a war. Right now, NATO is run by the United States principally as a private little club where the U.S. essentially dictates policy, although perhaps with a bit less, absolutism than the Athenians did. But it comes to the same thing. And now that we have no Russia left, there's no need for NATO to exist. NATO is an anachronism. NATO should go away because the United States does not need to have the rest of the world become its private policeman so it can dominate the world however it sees fit.
Sure, but unfortunately the reality is that they're not going away. They're not going to dissolve. They're only here and they're only exercising their power. With the new threat of ISIS, you think that the Russians are going to be supporting them in the long run, or do you think that it is a thing that has been created from within empire itself because it needs perpetual targets for perpetual war?
I'm not quite sure what to make of ISIS, but I want to say one thing at the start. I hate the term ISIS. It's a terrible acronym because it destroys what is an otherwise fine word. ISIS was the goddess of the Egyptians, like Athena to the Greeks. ISIS is another name for the River Thames in England. ISIS is a perfectly healthy, long-established name in Western, Mid-Eastern culture. And now when people think of that word, they're going to think of some contrived gang of thugs swanning around Egypt or Turkey or Iraq and becoming some great enemy of the West. I think it's disgusting. We should stop using the term ISIS as if it were something real. Now, getting back to what ISIS is, I really don't know. Edward Snowden, the great champion of intellectual liberty in the West, together with Bradley Manning and Sybil Edmonds and other people, argues or has evidence that ISIS was manufactured by the United States and Israel. Now, as bizarre as that sounds, hold on. According to Snowden, and I've sent him requests for information, he hasn't got back to me yet. The head of ISIS is a man named Elliot Shimon, or Shimon Elliot. He is a Jew who was trained by Mossad to put up this gang of Muslim thugs. The reason being is that there needed to be yet another threat to Israel's territorial security. As it is now, Israel does not face any real threats. Iran is not a threat that fizzled. Iraq is riven by internal dissent. It's a basket case. Syria is better positioned. It's in a better state, although it's still poor and it's still fighting an insurgency led by Israel America. But there's nothing really scary about Syria, nothing scary about Iraq. So you have to have someone scary to justify bringing the bombs and the jet fighters back to the Middle East to bomb the Arabs into non-existence. And this is what I call ISIS. Whether it exists as a threat, as a Muslim, radicalized Muslim force, I don't know. I'm not going to comment until I see something from a source that I can believe. But I do not believe this came out of nowhere. This was planned. And I just don't see it being a Muslim organization. It just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, the Muslims are basically intelligent people. Their resistance movements have a certain logic to them. In Afghanistan, when Osama bin Laden went there to help train the Arab Afghans and brought Arabs with him to fight in the resistance against the Russian army, there was a purpose to it. It was to liberate the country from an infidel. The Muslim resistance in Palestine is logical. Hamas, the political party and the government of Palestine, wants to get rid of the occupation. It speaks for the Palestinians against the corrupt, co-opted Fatah party led by Mahmoud Abbas. There is a sense of intelligence about the Muslims that does not get enough respect in the West. we tend to picture or focus on singular acts of violence and blow those up into some great image of irrationality and violence. I don't see any logic in ISIS. So my inclination is to disbelieve what the Western press tells me about it. And the Western press, as we know, is owned by pro-Israel owners like Rupert Murdoch. It's the TVs are owned by pro-Israel people, especially in Canada. So right away, you have to question whether anybody would even broadcast information that cast doubt on the nastiness of ISIS. So given the fact that's not likely to happen, my guess is that the information I'm getting has been pre-filtered and therefore is not trustworthy.
What do you think of the recent efforts by the Canadian government to hunker down, so it were, onto homegrown terrorism now moving abroad in the sense of Canadians joining and running? I mean, this hysteria about this. And I want to juxtapose this with the Lone Soldier program.
Well, Canada, first of all, does not really have a government. I mean, there's nothing nationalist about Harper's government. Harper is in the business of serving foreign corporations, foreign governments, and foreign capital. He does not serve Canadian interests. And if you've paid any attention to the litany of abuses of the Constitution that have befallen this country in the last 8 years, you know just how horrible Harper is. So when Harper gets up and starts going on about homegrown terrorism, he's manufacturing a threat that doesn't exist. It's important to terrorize people into thinking that people around the corner could be a threat to their existence. And so this is how you frighten a whole country. This is what happened in the Red Scare in the 1940s and 50s in the United States. Senator Joseph McCarthy would get up and talk about communists everywhere, their fellow travelers hiding under your bed, or who is your neighbor? Can you trust him? Denounce him to the government and the Un-American Activities Committee. This is a similar kind of fear-mongering. If a Canadian citizen chooses to go to Syria and fight with Bashar al-Assad's army, that's perfectly fine. If someone wants to go to Iraq and fight with ISIS, I have no problem with that. If someone wants to go to join the Israeli occupation force, well, I personally have a problem with that. Unfortunately, the government sees things exactly in the opposite way. It's perfectly valid to go and support Israel, to fight with the IDF against the Palestinians, even though the Palestinians are in the right. So Harper's making a value judgment. We define these people as terrorists. We define as who may or may not be terrorists. And we define these terrorists as good people, even though they clearly aren't. So when Harper decides to take aim at Canadians who may or may not be going off to fight in wars against Israel's enemies, he is showing his subservience to his real masters, which are in Tel Aviv, not in the electorate of Canada. Stephen Harper is a stooge of a foreign government. And so when he acts or he speaks, you have to realize that Canada has nothing to do with what he says or does. Canada is actually an enemy to Harper. He has to break this country's political spirit, break its constitutional history so that it can be reduced to a puppet state of a foreign government. All we are is something to be exploited in the name of a great empire, which is based in religious superstition and Jewish chauvinism, as well as corporate self-interest.
Well, we certainly morphed into that today. But, you know, in terms of, was Canada ever free of its beholdings to empire anyway? I mean, probably not. Anyway, Greg, I wanted to just shift it over and say there was an interesting comment I read in response to one of your petitions, which was about the Governor General.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I found what the person was saying was interesting in its practicality. Because they were basically asking that, you know, I mean, do you really think that the Governor General would even, you know, consider doing what you are petitioning the Governor General to do? You know, it's almost an impractical request, because of course, I mean, those that are in power is not going to, you know, 50,000 or 100,000 or 3 million Canadians or 5 million Canadians, you know, has signed a petition saying that, yes, I should relieve Harper of his duties, would still never, ever do that, because it's not in their interest to do that.
Not in whose interest? David Johnston's?
Yeah.
Well, I did a petition for two reasons, well, three reasons. Yes, I would like to see it done. I would like to see David Johnston develop a spine, take his balls out of Hawke, and do his job properly. Fire Stephen Harper. He has the authority to do it. Two, most people don't know what the Governor General does in this country. They think he's just some nice man or woman who goes to fancy state dinners and essentially has a very easy life, sort of swanning around the world or going to official functions. The Governor General is an important part of Canada's government, and that office has been debased and disrespected because the fact it's an appointed office, not an elected one. But we have to respect our appointed offices because they do have a function. The third thing is that David Johnston has been getting a free ride. This man literally could save the country. This man could fire Harper, force an election, and rid us of a tyrant. There is no reason why David Johnston should go to bed at night and sleep well. I want him to know that he is actively suborning treason in this country. I want Canadians to know that their country could be saved if only one person would do his duty. I want the Canadian public to shame the man into doing it. So I don't have much time for people who preemptively say, well, it'll never happen. Well, a lot of people thought the United Soviet Union would never collapse, but it did. That the sun would ever set on the British Empire, well, it did. Things can happen, and even things that look bizarre or a long shot, if you don't try, I mean, you never know, do you? So I think that David Johnston should be called to account for his indolence, his sloth, his sycophantic refusal to challenge Stephen Harper. Let's not forget that David Johnston is in a conflict of interest. He was nominated by Harper for the position. He did Harper a service as in a legal matter to exempt investigation of the Mulroney-era Airbus purchases. Then he gets this job. Mind you, a panel had to approve him, but it was Harper who got the nomination through. So David Johnston is doing his duty as a loyal servant of Stephen Harper, not of the Constitution. And that means David Johnston must be removed as Governor General. I just want the public to know that they have a hope. They can save their country. I'd love to see a million-man Canadian march go to Rideau Hall, and people egg Rideau Hall until David Johnston comes out and does his job. That's what I'd love to see. I'd love to see what happens. Look at Hong Kong. Students are occupying Hong Kong's business district. It's a mob scene. When was the last time Canadians marched on Ottawa and did anything remotely spirited like that?
Well, Greg, I'll say that there are often cases when that does happen. It is, I mean, I've witnessed them. I have friends. I've met people just even recently over this summer, you know, that were just coming back or were planning on going. You know, a lot of people do these kinds of things. So I'm not taking away any of that. I wanted to ask you because I found it interesting. You know, you have been calling for it. I think it's a perfectly valid and reasonable thing to do. I would like to see people do it as well. And, you know, I read a response to it in one of the papers. And I thought to myself, okay, that's an interesting response. It's true. And at some level, you know that there is an impracticality to it. But still, nonetheless, why not do it? You have to take the chance, right?
So. Well, it's ironically, it is the only avenue we have. It's not worth getting up listening to someone like Thomas Mulcair or Elizabeth May or Charlie Angus or anybody else get up and make some wonderful speech in the House of Commons that will have zero impact. The House of Commons is an emasculated echo chamber where Harper's tyranny can be heard bouncing off the walls.
Well, they were cheering once the vote went off for going and bombing Iraq recently.
Yeah, they were cheering.
Yeah.
the Harperites were cheering.
Well, yeah, when they won the vote, when they put to the vote, yeah, you know, to go and take their planes over and bomb.
Yeah, that's sort of...
When that happened, you know, there were cheering going on. This was reported in the media.
Yeah. But that's disgusting. I mean, they had the majority. They knew they were going to win. Are they so keen to murder people that they have to cheer their military? I mean, this is the sort of bloodlust that drives Stephen Harper. The man is repugnant. He is unethical. He is unconstitutional. And David Johnston, if you're listening, which I sincerely probably doubt you are, you...
Well, we could mail it to him.
We could mail it to him. I think we should mail this to him. He has to do his job. Otherwise, he is guilty of a crime. Because in the grand scheme of things, who is guilty for a great crime? The monster who commits it, or the good people who allowed it to happen? Who bears the greater responsibility for a mass murder?
Well, I'm just going to take a break here and leave people to pause. It's 5:47. You're listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Vancouver Co-op Radio, VFRO 101.5. Take out a membership in Co-op Radio. You get a share in the station. This makes you a part owner.
Co-op Radio is member-driven. When you become a member, you can get involved in programming and help run the station. Co-op Radio is
Наша любов ще не пропала, вона повернеться назад. Наша любов ще не пропала, вона повернеться назад.
Co-op Radio is cordial.
Co-op Radio is gay.
Co-op Radio is gay.
Ecology.
Comedy.
Feminism.
Philosophy.
Yoga.
Reggae.
Bicycle. Trade union.
Gospel. Live.
Local.
Гарні дівчата жіночками стали, заміж повиходили, доньок народили, доньки повиростали, знали, одружили.
All different?
All the time.
Те, що потрібно, виростила мене доньку царівну. Те, ще придатне, готувала те, ще доньки старанно. Я своєї тещі голубок сизені, я своєї тещі наші синрідненькі, те, що я ту маму люблю, поважаю, якби не дістала, а не ображаю.
Owned and operated by people like you, by your community.
Serve the people.
Is CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Find our complete program schedule at www.cooperadio.org.
Okay, and welcome back to Vancouver Co-op Radio. It is now 5:49. Greg, we have a couple more minutes left. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the Boston bombing. And you also wanted to talk about?
Fracking. Yeah, Russia doesn't seem... Russia's at the focus of a lot of American foreign policy agitation, but some of the reasons behind it might be a little hard to see. One thing I'd like to talk about briefly is the Boston Marathon bombing, which happened, I think, last April 15th, 2013, if I recall correctly. You remember that two Chechen brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers, were thought to have committed the attack. This was a great terror attack. I hate that word. It's used too much. Against the United States. But we know for a certainty that there was a lot of dirty tricks being played in Boston on that day. We know that there was a security drill. We also know that the Boston police had no inkling of any security threat because they were never informed of it. There was nothing to justify any increased security at the Boston Marathon. So we have to ask ourselves, why was there a training exercise there? And one of the things that was interesting is that it's not generally known is that there were some private security guards, security agents on site too. They came from a group called Kraft International. Now, these are nasty people. These are like private military, paramilitary organizations like, like Blackwater, which is now called XC, which is pretty much the private enforcement arm of Monsanto. Well, Kraft people were on site, but nobody will admit to having hired them. Not the Boston Police, not the Central Intelligence Agency, not the FBI, nobody. And yet, there are some very suspicious activities concerning Kraft International, especially ones that had backpacks that had Kraft International insignia on them, and that could well have contained the bombs that went off and crippled so many people. The Tsarnaev brothers could not possibly have been involved with this. The reason being is that the FBI had had a working relationship with them for so many years. There is no possible way that they could have surprised anybody by bombing the Boston Marathon. That's simply not feasible. It strains credulity to the breaking point. But it's interesting, though, what if the bombing was done deliberately to set up Chechens as the villains? Now, why would the Americans pick the Chechens? I mean, why Chechens as opposed to Iraqis or Iranians or Palestinians? Well, there's a theory behind that, and this is how it goes. The United States had failed to get Russian support to demonize Bashar Assad and allow for sanctions and military action against Syria. So Barack Obama decides to do Russia a favor. Now, despite the fact that the United States had been funneling money to the Chechens to destabilize Russia, because don't forget, America is the funder of the Chechen resistance, Chechen uprising. It tells Vladimir Putin, look, Vladya, let's try this. Here's what we'll do. We'll stage an attack on ourselves, and we will blame the Chechens for it. We will make Chechens terrorists in the eyes of the world. And that means it gives you the right to exercise more Russian repression against the Chechens in your own country. Now, if we do this, we want your support in the Security Council to oust Assad. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to set this up. We've got these two Patsy brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers. Their brother, Ruslan Tsarnaev, is very close with the CIA, former CIA station chief in Kabul, and they live in Maryland. And so he's got this, he's got a good relationship. As a matter of fact, their uncle used to run his business out of this guy's office. His name escapes me for the moment. Victoria Nuland, that was the woman earlier.
Earlier. Yeah. It's funny how it was.
Yeah. Anyway, so to make a long story short, the Boston Marathon bombing was conducted. These pressure cooker bombs went off with nasty effect. A lot of previously amputated people were placed on the scene. We know there were actors in the crowd. People who had lost limbs in Iraq were there to fake effects of the shrapnel that came from these pressure cooker bombs. And when that happened, the Tsarnaev brothers were systematically shot or seriously beaten to the point where they couldn't speak. Interestingly enough, there were Israelis on the ground also to help the Americans investigate this bombing. Now, why would Israelis be in Boston? Yeah, this is the question.
Yeah, but they're always there. I mean, they're always training the police and so on. I mean, they're integral. They're all already involved, right? You're just pointing out that that there's evidence that they were on the ground.
Yeah, but has Israel ever been involved in security for the Boston Marathon? I would submit not. How did Israel think it could help investigate this?
It's a training exercise anyway.
But why was there a training exercise?
And that's an interesting coincidence, isn't it? Because there have been a number of training exercises when this kind of shit's gone down.
Well, there were training exercises when the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were hit also. So it provides convenient cover. Oh, let's ignore the bombs. They're not real. So it kind of makes me wonder, you know, it makes more sense to look at this as a self-inflicted wound, to send a message to Russia to stop supporting Assad and the United Nations Security Council. Putin, contrary to Bush or Obama, does have something called integrity. And although he may not be a Democrat or perhaps not a nice man, politically speaking anyway, he is what I call an honorable autocrat. He is a predictable man. He knows what he knows. He knows his own self-interest.
So are you saying that the Russians did not go for it and the Americans still and the Israelis still did the drill?
That's right.
And the Russians said, no, we love Syria so much, we're going to support them.
So much loving Syria, but there was no reason to inflict wanton damage on a country that was not a threat to anybody. Now, I don't know whether Putin agreed to this or whether this was just a one-off thing that Obama volunteered to do to show Russia his good faith.
Or right.
Maybe the Americans, as somebody has argued, needed to have a physical attack on their soil to remind them of just how much they need their government to take away their liberties.
But that doesn't hurt, right? I mean,
no.
that's always par for the course. Now, I just want to switch over because of time. We were talking about fracking as well. You had something to say about that.
Right. As you know, fracking is probably the most destructive industry you can imagine. It pollutes the groundwater. It involves massive destruction of land. To get such little shale oil from the deep within the Earth's mantle or crust. So the fact is that for the United States to have oil independence, it needs to have a steady supply. Right now it gets a lot from Canada, but it wants to limit its dependency on Middle Eastern oil. There's enough frackable oil, let's put it that way, under the United States to sustain it for years, decades. Some say it's more than all of Saudi Arabia, but I don't know. I haven't checked the figures that closely, but it's a considerable amount. So if you've got all this oil and you want to make money from it, as well as supply your own needs, why not try to sell it to Europe? But wait a minute, Europe gets a lot of oil from Russia. And there are seriously strong pipelines that go from northwest Russia and Siberia as far east as Holland and Germany and to Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic, even down as far as Slovenia. Mm-hmm. Now, the point is, if you want to do that, well, we got to cut off the supply of oil from Russia. So you want to convince the Europeans to buy fracked oil from America. And Canada recently won a victory having its bitumen labeled non-dirty by the European Union over great protest. And this was not a victory for anybody. This was a victory only for Canadian self-interest. So right now it's profitable to sell oil to Europe, but only if the United States can convince Europe to end its traditional reliance on Russia. So the more they can ostracize Russia and have sanctions inflicted upon Russia, the greater the possibility of selling oil, dirty or otherwise, to Europe increases. Now, it makes no sense. You have to have shipping. There's a lot of danger for oil spills. It's an absurd scenario. But again, the oil industry is not known for its logic or rationality. So that's the reason why Russia's in the bad books of Israel-America.
So, Greg, we've come to the end of it now. Thanks a lot for joining us and telling us your views. Welcome to stay. We've got some new guests in the room. We're just going to catch up with them and then come right back.
Okay.